Okay, see if I can answer a bit more efficiently today. In your book, The Basic Method of Meditation, it writes, meditation is a way to achieve letting go. Does it mean the purpose of meditation is to train oneself, incline to mind of letting go? It might take one's whole lifetime, possibly. It might take many lifetimes. Just let go of all your impatience. Don't rush. No, meditation is the art of letting go, and also achieves, in a sense, the total letting go, where there's nothing left at all. Freedom. So just it's not the path of letting go, and the end is just everything disappears. You dissolve. Remember what I said that, I don't know if I said it. One of the monks I met a long time ago, he told me that when people asked him, are you enlightened? He would answer, I'm highly eliminated. Not illuminated, but eliminated. I thought that was really cool. So, the more enlightened you are, the more eliminated you are. Well, that's quite nice. So it is letting go. A few days ago, you were talking about an athlete break new record because they think they can, mind power. But thinking I can, doesn't it arise will and make you want to strive? Exactly. That's why all those athletes just, sometimes after they push their bodies so far, they either get sick or they just have nothing left to do in life. So their will creates a lot of frustration. So you can't always be the first, the best, and after a while you just, that becomes your personality, the Usain Bolt. But you know, I can go fast on Usain Bolt in an aircraft. But thinking you can doesn't arise will, yes, and make you want to strive, yes. Especially about thinking they can, mind power. There's also the ability to do things with wisdom, as well as just the thing about letting go. Stop. You don't need to be a winner. You know, to be the best, what do you want to do that for? So if you're the best, then you have to always just compete and worry about other people. That's why I always say, never be a winner, be a loser. Me, I've lost so much in my life, except weight. I can't tend to lose weight. Try to let go, but you know, just more stuff comes in. Anyway, to be a loser means you're free. To be a winner means you've got lots of work to do. Ajahn, is missing the deceased and good ties with him or her a form of not being able to let go? If it really is missing, and you feel that your life has no real meaning and there's a big hole in your life, it is looking at the two bad bricks in the wall. So you don't look at what's been taken away from you, you look at what you've had. The good bricks in the wall. It's wonderful, you had this beautiful time with that person. You know, I always talk in funerals about the simile of the concert. Well, after the concert is finished, I would always clap and shout for more. And after the encore, that would be when you'd have to leave. You know, I never cried or felt sad after a great concert. I always thought, well, how lucky I was to have been there at the time. What great music that was, what great memories they were. And I just have these wonderful memories of growing up in London and seeing some of the greatest bands, you know, praying. And I always tell the story, with my brother, we went to this pub in North London, you know, upstairs. A band was playing, and only six of us turned up to watch. And the lead singer was called Rod Stewart. So he was just young in those days, so he could get like private audiences and private concerts. So a lot of that stuff in those days, you remember those beautiful times, happy times. But after the concert, I never cried. always thought what a wonderful thing it was to have been there, how lucky I was. And that's how I, when people who die, the loved ones, great time we had together, thank you so much. Wouldn't have missed that for the world. Thank you, Father. And so you don't miss them, you actually feel gratitude for them. So grateful that you've had the time with them. That's like the mudita, the sympathetic joy, the positive thinking. Instead of saying, oh, what am I going to do now? So you mentioned this morning about remembering past good times to feel good about oneself through meditation. This is contrary to letting go of past and future. It is a little bit contrary, but it's a skillful means. If you are going to remember the past, remember the good stuff, the inspiring stuff. At least let go of the bad stuff. And if you are going to think of the future, don't be anxious, don't be fearful, be hopey. Don't worry, be hopey. And hopey means you look at the future with a positive mind. Who knows what might happen? Perhaps something wonderful will happen. And that's called being hopey. Looking at the future with a positive mind. There's only one day left. Two days. Be hopey, who knows? 2 days, you're enlightened. Woo! Be hopey. So, if you are negative, that is the cause of so many problems. So, that came when apparently somebody said around the United States, people had all these billboards, don't worry, be happy. And yeah, you don't want to do the same old thing, don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be hopey. That's what it really meant. So look upon the future. Oh, it might go wrong. What happens if it doesn't go wrong? And that is this famous story by that other great English philosopher. And that English philosopher was a little bear called Winnie the Pooh. And Winnie the Pooh, he never went to Harvard or Cambridge. He just had a natural bear awareness and the wisdom which came from it. And one day he was walking with his best friend, little Piglet, back from, I think, from Rabbit's house. They were going home. And they had a long way to walk in the forest. And as they were walking in the forest, the wind started blowing fiercer and fiercer. And a storm was coming. And as the wind grew fiercer and stronger, first twigs started falling off the trees, and then branches, and then bang! Whole trees were uprooted by the force of the storm. It was dangerous. And poor little Piglet, like many tiny people, got more and more scared, more and more anxious, and had an anxiety attack. He held the paw of Piglet and squeezed it so hard. He said, I'm so afraid. I can't go on any further. What would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? And that was actually a possibility. Trees were falling all over the place. What would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? And for 1 second, Winnie the Pooh was scared too. But then, his natural bear awareness and bear wisdom started to arise. He got insight from bear awareness. And his insight was reply to little Piglet, yeah, you say, what would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? I say, what would happen if a tree fell when we weren't underneath it? Which was much more possible, more probable. So instead of looking at the future with a negative mind, what would happen if it fell when we were underneath it? The answer is, what would happen if it fell when we weren't underneath it? Positive thinking. And I told that story because I just got an email today and another sort of invitation to this cancer group. They call it Solaris now over in Cottesloe. I've been going there for, it'd be the 27th year in a row now, going there. And when they had a big opening, I asked them, why do you keep inviting me? You know, I'm getting old now, you've heard all my stories and jokes and stuff. He said, oh no, there's something there we want every year. And they told me the first year I went there, there was a woman who had bad cancer, did all the surgery, chemotherapy, or whatever it was, and she was in remission. But she kept going there because she was so anxious. And she asked me a question, which apparently she'd asked all the other doctors and psychologists and psychiatrists. No one could answer her question until this bald-headed, brown-robed, funny guy came up to talk to them. And after my talk, she put her hand up and asked her a question, which no one had been able to answer yet. She said, what would happen if my cancer returned? Because she was so worried about it. You know, it's so difficult, painful. Oh, it's just such a big burden, going through a cancer and being in remission. And she thought, if it comes back again, I can't handle that again. And you can understand why. She said, what would happen if it came back again? And Ajahn Brahm replied, what would happen if it didn't come back again? And actually she got it, she understood it first time. What would happen if it didn't come back? She never thought about that. That was, don't worry, being hopey. And apparently the cancer has never come back, but she comes back every time I go there. Simple things like that, changing attitudes, looking at it a slightly different way, solves the problem. So, instead of missing your loved one, and sometimes you think, oh, I've lost something. I've lost my mother, I lost my grandma. You haven't lost them. You've had them. You've gained them. You've known them. It's a great gain for you. Would you rather have never known that person? Of course not. So it was a gain for you. Well done. Maybe you'd like longer with your loved one, but for my dad, 16 years, that's pretty good. So, remembering the past good times to feel good upon self during meditation, it's a skillful means. Is it contrary to letting go of past and future? It leads to letting go of past and future. It's a skillful means to get to the present. Number next question. I'm worried about laughing too much and forgetting or running out of laughter and returning home a grumpy old mummy. Okay, can I take a bag of laughter with me from Jhana Grove just in case? Yes, of course. That bag, laughter comes from the lungs. So because you laugh, it strengthens the lungs. And it means you're more likely to laugh when you go home. And if that doesn't work, just look in the mirror, two fingers, push up, make a funny smile, and you always end up laughing at yourself. So, returning, don't worry, be hopey. You probably won't run out of laughter. You don't. Once you get grumpy, you get grumpy about being grumpy and angry about, fed up with being fed up, depressed about being depressed. So that leads to more and more grumpiness. So but you've laughed so much here, you've trained yourself so much, you just can't stop. You've been addicted. And once you're addicted to the pleasure of laughing, it's very hard to get off those addictions. You don't want to. My thoughts can appear overwhelming and repetitive. That's what repetitive means. That's what they've got down here. It should be repetitive, and it's repetitive. Where do they come from? Are they that come embedded within my delusion? Your thoughts come because you're bored. Just the same way, you're at home, say what to do, turn on the TV, look at a book, go to the refrigerator, go to eat something, email someone, call somebody up, anything to just escape from this moment. That's where thoughts come from. So when you're really content and happy and peaceful, no thoughts. Nice being peaceful. So that's where they come from. And they appear repetitive because you haven't got any new thoughts. So you have to work over the old thoughts. Just like, what is it called? The movies. They always have reruns. Old movies they play again and again and again and again and again. Or if they have new movies, it's the same movies. But, you know, just upgraded or just reworked, a new sort of director or something, same old stories. In fact, all the movies I remember looking at when I was a young man, they were all exactly the same. So much so that in the college, the little students' club there, that they used to have some films once a week, and had to have one student who would actually choose them and actually explain them what they were. So I remember there was like Zulu, Sex and Violence in South Africa. There was Cain or something, Sex and Violence in the Midwest. James Bond, Sex and Violence all over Europe. And that's all it was. Just sex and violence in different parts of the world or different times. And that's all the movies were. Because apparently that somebody told me, I think it was put on some Buddhist network site, that Jessica something Parker, was it? From Sex and the City. What was her name? It was Jessica Parker. I thought it was another name in there somewhere. But anyway, Jessica Parker, she was seen, actually photographed, in some coffee shop reading a copy of Opening the Door of Your Heart. Oh, that might be the American version, who ordered this truckload of dung. So she saw it, so I said, wow, she must be a follower of mine. So because, you know, she was a star of this movie, a TV series, Sex and the City. Oh, okay. But anyway, so you've seen them, you must know. got you out. No. So, I was expecting that she to sort of give me a call or email and see if you get me on her show. Well, why not? But then I thought, how can you actually get on a show, Sex in the City? They have to change it a bit. There'll be no sex in the monastery. And no one would listen to that, would they? Because it's boring. That's people that don't want. They want violence. We don't do violence. They want sex and romance. We don't do that. So that's why I've never been invited on a show. Anyway. What was that question anyway? Just to make sure. Oh yeah, the thoughts were repetitive. Yeah, just the old shows, they rework over and over. It's all the same. Did the Buddha comment on the significance of transferring merits to the devas in the suttas? Do we have to do it every time we do a good deed? We don't really need to transfer merits to devas. I say that's like giving a donation to Bill Gates. These are devas, you know, they've made it. They're beautiful and happy. But yeah, you can give like loving kindness. What devas really like? Teaching Dhamma. They just, so that you are, that's one of the reasons I say that if any of you get really teary and weepy during meditation, just go for it, just cry your eyes out. Because I just can't stop myself. Two places in India, I just can't stop, I cry. One of them is the Vulture's Peak. You know, you go up there, that's where the Buddha sat. That's where Sariputta became enlightened. And that's, it hasn't changed. They haven't built a big temple over it. It's just as it was, just about. And you go up there and you can sit there and you know that that was where the Buddha sat. And that's goosebumps. That's amazing. and you get so much energy. Wow, you just start crying with joy and happiness. And the other place where I really get emotional is that Dhammacakka Buddha statue, which is in the museum outside of the Deer Park, Sarnath, just outside of Benares. So I knew it was there when I... It's most, one of the most famous statues of the Buddha in the world. It's got this big circle around it. And when I first went there, just I wanted to go and see it. It was one of the things I really wanted to do. And of course, if you go to that national those museums in India, there's no guidebooks. There's no one even to ask. You know, it's the Indian tradition. You say, is it over there? They say, oh, yes. And you ask me, is it over that way? I said, oh, yes. So you have to find your own way. So I was just wandering around and then turned a corner and it was the end of the gallery, the end of the corridor. And oh, it's just so beautiful. I started tearing, crying. I enjoyed that. It was beautiful. For me, it was something about that statue was amazing. Really beautiful. It really sort of got to me. But the next time I went there, you know, taking a group there, and you know, you want to do the sightseeing around there, but that's what I really wanted to do, to have a nice cry. And I went there. I was going to restrain myself, sorry. I decided I'd restrain myself, you know, and just, you know, just be mindful and to be restrained and stuff. And as soon as I was, a lot of people there, as soon as I turned the corner, I couldn't help myself. Oh, so beautiful. And the third time I went there, I said, okay, I can't stop it, I'm going to enjoy it. And so I went there, I knew exactly where it was, went there, turned the corner, and I was just waiting to be inspired, blissed out, nice tears of joy coming up, and they were renovating. There was a painter painting the ceiling, and this big cloth over that statue. You couldn't see it. And that was just one of the things I was longing for, and I was so disappointed. It's a lesson for me. You know, just when you plan, you expect things, and it doesn't work out. You say, oh, no. And without saying anything, the workman pulled off the cover. I had another cry. It's just beautiful. It's just joy, happiness. Go for it. And there was on this retreat center some years ago, an Australian man, maybe about 45. And he came into the interview and said, look, Ajahn Brahm, something really strange is happening. You know, when I'm sitting here, I get teary. And then I asked him, I said, well, that's okay, what's wrong with that? He said, is that all right? And then I understood what was going on. He said, when was the last time you cried? And he got very serious and he said, when I was about 12, and my father told me that Australian boys don't cry. And I said to him, mate, you've got a lot of crying to catch up on. And he did. He was in here just crying about 3 or 4 times a day, crying his eyes out. And you know, he got so much compassion from others. Especially when I said there's just no joy and peace coming up. And if any of you guys are looking for a partner, he was just so popular afterwards. People had so much compassion for him. I thought, oh yeah, he's a nice guy. He's emotional. They gave him so much support. So if any of you want to go as single, you're looking for a partner, start crying. It's amazing how attractive that gets. Anyway, I don't know why I know those things, but there we go. So that's, it was just loving kindness coming up. It's just joy and happiness. It's wonderful. And if you do that, it just, you don't get sort of thoughts. You're just so happy. You just, thoughts can't come in. You're just so full of joy and happiness. It's great. Okay, well, the reason I said that was because why are those places powerful? And some of them, they're just, the devas are still there. Remember, some of these deva realms, they say, like, what was it? 100 years of human life is just like half a day for them. I forget what the maths is, But, you know, 2,500 years since the Buddha. And for many devas, it's just a day or two. They still remember. It's like just yesterday, the Buddha was sitting there. The Buddha was passing away there. Imagine that. They're still there. Looking after. You can feel energy in some of these places. That's why. Devas are still... But you don't need to really to... Obviously respect devas, but you don't need to actually to spread merit to them. Real nice deva story. You want deva stories? I like deva stories. Here we go. I thought I was going to do this quickly, but anyway, late night again. The deva stories that there was. Which one should we do? The one about the monk in Thailand, or the deva in the forest? Oh, okay. Here we go. Forget about the questions. This was, first of all, time-wise, an old story. There was this Thai forest monk, Ajahn Chop. Yeah, I think that was the name. And could be Ajahn Orn. Anyway, one of those two. I spent the rains during the Second World War in Burma. In those days, you didn't need passports. You just walk there and any monastery will look after you. So he was in there during the Second World War, but when the Thailand capitulated to the Japanese without any fight, the Thais were looked upon as being the enemies of the British in Burma. So any Thai monk in Burma was considered to be a spy. And my ancestors, the English, would actually, you know, sometimes interrogate them quite violently. It was really dangerous for being a Thai monk in Burma at that time. So the monastery where he was staying, they told me, you better get out quickly. You know, it's not safe for you. And they couldn't go the normal road because all those checkpoints had the British soldiers on there. So the only way he could escape was going over the jungle, over the mountains, which was a really long, dangerous, arduous trek for many days with no food. And so there he was, just walking through the jungles on the old jungle paths, hadn't eaten for days. And I know those mountains. I was up there once and close to the border. They're really steep, you know, slopes, up and down, and it's really tiring and hot. And there's no one there. It's wilderness. And so he was getting so weak, exhausted, and no food, that he started to really be concerned whether he would make it or not. He thought he was going to die of exhaustion, no food, for days. And that's when he started thinking about some of the stories in the old suttas of heavenly beings giving food to a monk, to a really good monk. And that's where he thought, well, I'm a really good monk, I keep my precepts, I'm meditating, you know, I'm devoted to being a monk. If there are devas, if they really exist, they should come and help a monk like me. That was his thought. And about a couple of minutes later, he turned a bend on the path, and there on the path was a man standing with the old tiffin cans. You know the old tiffin cans? Little metal bowls, one after the other, four or five. One of them has rice, the other one has some curries and maybe a banana or two. He was standing there with the tiffin can. Really well dressed. You don't see people like Bangkok dress. You don't see people dressed like that in the jungle. And he hadn't seen a village for days. And so as the monk went past, because our rules were in those days, you're not supposed to say anything. Either they say, please, you know, come and take some food, the word is Nimon Krup, or you just walk past, you don't stop. And so as he was walking past, this monk was walking past, wondering who this was, that's when this gentleman put his hand up and said, Nimon Krup. And so the monk opened his bowl, to receive alms food. Hot, delicious food. Bangkok food. In the jungle, it's sticky rice. This was, you know, the soft rice. In the jungle, it'd be like a monkey paw or something really gross like that, because that's all they have to eat. But there was really hot, good Bangkok food. And, you know, obviously he thought, how did he know I was coming here? And how did he have hot food prepared? Where on earth did he get this high quality food in the middle of nowhere? And so the monk, you know, he broke one of the old traditions. He asked this man, where do you come from? And this well-dressed man in the jungle didn't answer. He just, with his finger, pointed upwards. And when they told that story, he said, what could that be except for a deva? He asked for help, because he was a good monk, and he got that help. And the deva gave him his food for the day so he could survive. Deva was helping him. Now, you fast forward to maybe about 38 years ago, when there was a young, very thin English monk on my, say, my travels, you know, just walking around wherever you go. And I was actually in the mountains, the Phupan Mountains, in the center of the northeast of Thailand. In those days, it was not developed at all. Just a dirt road, and just, you know, villages were few and far between. I'd eaten well that morning, but I'd run out of water. I was really thirsty. It was really hot, and I started to get feel dehydrated. And, you know the signs, and it's very, very weak. And I came to like a ridge, and down in the valley there, you know, you saw there was a village. Well, four or five houses. And I knew from experience that one of those houses would be a general store, which, you know, sold hempen rope, cigarettes, kerosene, you know, matches, you know, just supplies, including they'd always have Pepsis. So standing up there on the ridge, I remembered that story of Ajahn Chah. And I said, I'm a good monk. I was. I kept my rules and precepts, meditated. And I thought, this is the test to see if there really are devas. You know, because I knew that story, but I was still a scientist, skeptic. If there are devas, give me a Pepsi. Because I needed it. You know, it gave me some salt, sugar, and caffeine, and boost of liquid. That's, you know, what people used to drink all the time. So I said, okay, let's see. If there are devas, let's have a Pepsi. And as I walked with my gaze down, not looking to the left or the right, mindful restraint, in the corner of my eye, I saw, yeah, that was, we just passed the general store, and no one stopped me. No one said any more crap. And I thought, there are no such things as devas. And as soon as that thought came up, I heard someone running behind me saying, Nimon Krap. I hadn't spoken, hadn't said anything. And the person was there with an open bottle of Pepsi Cola. And I was quite impressed, but you know, maybe just coincidence. And then another person ran behind with another bottle of Pepsi Cola opened. And then a third, and then a fourth, and then a fifth, and then a sixth, and then a seventh, and then an eighth, and then a ninth. Now, any of you who know Thai culture, nine is like the magic number. In Chinese Singapore, it's number eight. Number seven is in Korea. But number nine is the number. And there I sat down on a bench and put all these bottles of Pepsi Cola, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Those devas, they really want to prove something. There's no way you can drink nine bottles of Pepsi. I just drank a little bit of each and then gave the rest back, you know, because that's what they do, share it with other people. But without any asking, no preparation, that they just gave me 9 bottles. To me, that was, from that time on, okay, there are such things as Davids. Now, even more interesting. I know the people involved in this one, know the monk involved. But, I told this story, I think, when I was in Singapore once, I was invited to the Thai ambassador's house in Orchard Road. You know, want to give me lunch there, and I gave a little talk. I told this story. The Thai ambassador said, yeah, yeah, and I know that's absolutely true, because he was a disciple of, because being an ambassador high class of the Royal Monastery in Thailand, Wat Bawon. So, an American monk, can't tell you what his name is, but you know, you probably don't know him, he had finished doing Peace Corps work in Thailand. And after doing Peace Corps work, you know, he just got to know a little bit about Buddhism, and so he thought, why not just spend a few months temporary ordination as a Buddhist monk? You know, just see what it's like. It's a nice thing to finish off his Peace Corps work in Thailand. And so, he was staying at a hotel on the outskirts of Bangkok. He didn't know, you know, what do you do? How do you become a monk if you want to become a monk? So he asked the concierge, who, you know, he knew other things for Westerners, but not how to become a monk. And so he gave some advice, no, not entirely accurate. He said, well, I've seen Western monks at this monastery in Bangkok before. Maybe that's the place for you to go. It's a royal monastery, Wat Bawon. So what to do, he said, get some food, you know, and then go there early in the morning, wait outside, and when the monks come round on arms round, put some food into the first monk's bowl and ask, I want to become a monk. It's not exactly the best advice, especially the time he got there was really early in the morning. The whole place was locked up and closed. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, or even earlier, 3:30. He was walking up and down deserted street, and then didn't know what to do, and a Thai gentleman approached him and asked him what he wanted to do, why he was there. And the Thai gentleman spoke perfect English. Not only that, but he was wearing like just traditional Thai clothes, not modern stuff. At that time in the morning, was a bit weird. And when this American said he wanted to become a monk, the Thai gentleman said, well, you're far too early. The monks won't come out from arms around for another hour and a half or more. But he said, never mind. I can actually take you inside to have a look, to pass the time. And so he got these keys out and opened up these metal gates. And then he went through the metal gates with the American. And then he opened up the main Upasita Hall, with all the ordinations, you know, really ornate paintings outside. And that is actually where the kings of Thailand ordain, you know, temporarily sometimes. And so he opened up that hall, turned the lights on, and then had all these murals in the temple hall. And this Thai gentleman just knew everything about these paintings. You know, it's like a cartoon, but you've got to actually, it doesn't go like left to right, you know, like in the cartoons of Garfield. It goes this way and up and here. It tells a story. Mostly from the Jatakas or Dhammapada commentary or something, and you can actually work out these amazing stories. And he went from panel to panel on this ordination hall, and when he finished, he timed it perfectly. At the end of the guided tour, this Thai gentleman said to the American, well, the monk is going to come out soon, so you just go out the gate, turn right, and just wait, not for any monk, because an old monk will come out. He's the person to ask. So he did that, and the Thai gentleman locked up. So, the old monk came out, the American put some food in the bowl, and the monk said, just wait here, and I will just take you inside when I come back. And that's how he got the introduction and to start the training to be a monk. But after 2 or 3 days, the American complained. And he said, well, look, the monk you've given me to, you know, train in, like, the basic rules, what you've got to do as a monk, and all the chanting, his English is terrible. You know, a lot of the time I just struggle to understand what he's saying. And the Thai monks explained that this is the best English speaker in the whole monastery. And at that, the American said, well, what about that temple attendant I met the first day, who let me in the gate. And at that they say, what are you talking about? There is no temple attendant like that. And you can't go through that metal gate. That's the king's gate. I know that myself. I've passed it many times. The only time that's open is when royalty visits. Even just monks can't go through that gate unless you're royalty. So he said, what are you talking about? And you can't turn the electricity on at that place. And they realized there's something very supernatural happening, so they took him straight to the abbot, who was Somdet Yanasangwara. He later became the supreme patriarch of Thailand. He died just about a year or two ago. And as soon as he started speaking, the abbot stopped him and called in a secretary, because this was very strange. Because, you know, even the abbot can't go through that gate by himself. It's a royal gate. And no temple attendant has that key, nor the key to the main hall. And you can't even turn the electricity on there where he said he turned it on. And not even the abbot knew all the stories of those little temple drawings. This Thai man, you know, the attendant, he knew not only the stories, he knew who donated for that, because there's some in memory of someone who passed away, or a child who died, or got very sick. He knew everything. And just the secretary wrote everything down to take a record of this, because this was really weird. And then at the very end of the interview, when he said as much as he could about this Thai gentleman, describing what was he wearing, and he said, look, really old-style Thai dress, not modern dress at all. But what did it look like? You know what Westerners would say? Well, you know, Thai people, they all look the same. But, you know, you can do better than that. Describe him. He said, well, I don't know. And he was scratching his head and just trying to think, and then he stopped. It was him. It was him. He had a portrait on the wall. King Rama V. The main sponsor of Wat Bawan. It was him. An old king. That's why he could go through that gate. He was royalty. That's why he knew everything about those paintings. He was there when they were commissioned. And that was spooky. But that was absolutely true. I know that monk. I haven't seen him for a while. For actually quite a few years now. And I know that story. A heavenly being, the sponsor of that temple, a king of Thailand, looking after the place, seeing there was a monk, a man who wanted to do something really noble and holy, become a monk, and just looked after him, opened doors which only kings can open, go through doors, open doors and explain everything in such a way. That's actually in the history of that temple. The king, long dead, came to help someone ordain. It's really spooky. But it's beautiful. It's absolutely true. So, that's the Deva story. It's gorgeous. Anyway, okay, let's get lots of questions. What is the origin of life? Do you believe in the Darwin theory of evolution? Does the existence of dinosaur age in line with Buddhist belief? Of course, you've got two parallel evolutions. The evolution of the stream of consciousness and the evolution of the animal forms in which it takes a home. So yes, human beings evolve, but we're not just a body. We've got five components of existence. The body is only one of them. So you can actually go and get reborn in an animal, in a parrot. One of my disciples said when he dies, he's been a very good person, he wants to get reborn as a dog. And I thought after, reborn as a dog? What do you want to do that for? Well, he said, I'm fed up going to work every day. And I like sleeping. And dogs, imagine, dogs, especially in a place like Australia. They don't have to go to work. They don't have to go in the traffic. They don't have to have all these bosses telling them what to do and, you know, trying to have office politics and getting on in their career. They don't have to worry about how much money they earn and how much tax they have to pay. They just lie around and sleep all day. All the only work they have to do, you know, is to be patted every now and again, wag their tail, and allow, you know, take their owner out for a walk every morning. They're a dog. You know, it's a pretty cushy life. Nice and warm, and just, you know, nice and sleep. You get good sort of health care. No worries at all. And so, then I said, well, in Australia, after you've been born as a dog, when you're a puppy, in the first few weeks, you have to go to the vet to get de-sexed. At that point, he said, okay, I don't want to be a dog. It's apart from that, he was really getting into it. So, yeah, all these different sort of vehicles you can get reborn into. It's the evolution of the stream of consciousness, if you like. It's growth and development. As you get wiser and kinder. And also just the bodies as well. And if you don't believe that, I always ask people to get on online and just get on Google and just Google in Alex, that's A-L-E-X, second word T-H-E, the third word parrot, P-A-R-R-O-T. African grey parrot who some psychologists in, I think it was St. Louis, United States, they decided to use a technique which they had developed on teaching children who had learning difficulties how to speak, how to, you know, get some vocabulary. The same techniques which they developed on, you know, children with learning difficulties, they tried on this African grey parrot. So it didn't just have, you know, just one or two words, you know, like pieces of eight or pretty Polly or whatever like that. It had a huge vocabulary, and it used it intelligently, which was weird. You could have a conversation with this parrot. It wasn't sort of dubbed, it was actually quite some time ago, so it didn't have those visual effects. It was real. This parrot could talk with you. And what convinced me once when I was seeing a video of this, Spellbound, is this real? And they asked the parrot another question, and the parrot said, I'm bored, I'm fed up, I've had enough of this, or something like that. It was a parrot with attitude. And have a look, that parrot, you know, died some time ago. But, you know, they had other parrots they used the same technique on. And when these other younger parrots made a mistake, Alex, you know, the senior, said, you're doing it wrong, that's not right. He would correct his young disciples. He's a parrot, African grey parrot, who lives, they usually live 60, 70, 80 years or something. So check that out for yourself. Alex the parrot. It's spooky. And it just shows you that, you know, the difference between animals and humans is not that much. Ajahn, why no chanting in the morning for this retreat? But it's still a good, lovely retreat. Thanks for the compassion. Oh, we thought about it, but, you know, you can't fit in everything. So anyway, you can do your own chanting, you know, in your room tonight. What do you think of NLP, or Programming Our Thought Inner Speech? Does it help effectively? People always want the shortcuts, but I never heard anybody get very far with that. What is positive attitude? Right attitude. Positive attitude is for forgiving you, because I've been talking all week about that. And right attitude, you should know by now. That's my right attitude. Right attitude, positive attitude is seeing the bricks in the wall. Only two bad bricks in the wall, 998 good bricks. To see the nice side, and it's worth it. It gets you peaceful, enlightened, teaches you how to be kind and love. And negative attitude, I don't know why people do that. It doesn't help anyone, but in particular it doesn't help you. I've experienced quite a lot of joy in meditation for some time. It doesn't seem to go deeper, though, as you have described in your book instruction. What can be the reasons? Impatient. Gives you experiencing joy. Isn't that lovely? You got joy coming to meditation? Why do you want more? So say, this is good enough for me. I'm having a really good time. Go and speak to other people and say, you've got joy and you want more? It's wonderful you've got joy. I've been depressed and suffering and fed up all retreat, 8 days, and you complain about having joy. You won't realize it's really unfair. You should know what other people are like in this retreat. So, if you are content with the joy you have, you don't need much to be happy. You're content with what you have. This is so wonderful. I've got some joy in the meditation. As soon as you don't want anything more, that's when it deepens. So the reason is you're wanting something more. You read my book, and that's given rise to craving and desire. Sorry, it's my fault. You shouldn't have read the book. But that's what happens when you let go, give up, don't want anything. That's when you get great happiness. For example, there was Ananda, the disciple of the Buddha. Right-hand monk, always there looking after the Buddha. And when the Buddha was about to pass away, he thought, oh my goodness, I am not enlightened yet. How can I ever become enlightened, poor Ananda? I couldn't get enlightened when the Buddha was alive. Now he's dead. Ah! And so, you know, he spent a lot of time organizing things and doing work for other people. You know, just like Venerable Chanda, doing so much work for other people. And he thought, oh my goodness, you know, you're leaving tonight and Ajahn Brahm is not around. Oh my goodness, what am I going to do? I can't get enlightened here. What am I going to do when I sort of go over to England? And that's what Ananda thought. But then, Mahakasapa decided to have a big meeting, like a conference. And all the people invited to the conference were all enlightened. 499, because they wanted to get all the teachings together, and just so we know what the Buddha taught, what the Buddha didn't teach. 499 arahats, they decided to invite Ananda because, you know, well, he knew so much. And so he was going to go to the conference the next day. All the other monks, all his friends and mates were all enlightened except for him. Now to understand what it's like, imagine at the end of this retreat, I make the announcement that every one of you is enlightened except for you, Tom. How do you feel, you, Tom? Oh no, that sucks. That's not good. I've been trying so hard. But you've got one more night. So the following morning, they're having this big sort of meeting. So that was it. And Anders said, right, I'm really going to go for it tonight. Enlightenment or bust. Meditating, 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 using every trick he knew, everything he'd heard from the Buddha, and when the dawn came, wasn't enlightened at all. And he was just so fed up. He looked, so you know, it was another sort of an hour or so until the conference started. So what did he do? Yeah, went to take a nap. So he gave up. And so when he went to his room, when he went to lay down, before his head hit the pillow, he became the 500th enlightened being. He let go, he gave up trying, he gave up wanting, and then he became enlightened. We call that the Ananda method of enlightenment. It's one of the reasons I encourage you to take naps many times a day. To give yourself as much chance by doing it regularly. Hit the pillar. Oh, not this time. But try again. And then the last part of the story was the following. He's an enlightened monk now. But, you know, would his friends believe him? After all these years of not becoming enlightened, so he decided to come in late. So, when they started the meeting, he hadn't turned up yet, so they locked the doors. And so Ananda, after the doors were locked, Ananda came in through the keyhole. He made an entrance. And they said, ah, well done. Another arahat. Come, you're one of us. So that's Ananda's enlightenment. And that's the way to become. So you've got plenty of chances. No, not this time, but maybe. You know, already some of you experience, you've been meditating all day, and when you sort of go down to sleep, you lie down, you get nimittas come up. Great lights in the mind. A lot of peace and happiness. Why? It's the Ananda method. You'd let go. You're letting go. You're not trying anymore. You're not wanting stuff. It's amazing what happens. Dear Ajahn, Ajahn Sujata and Venerable Anario both said that mindfulness of breathing is not in the original body, Satipatthana. May I ask why you've included it in your translations, please? They have to have some pretty good evidence for that. That doesn't make sense to me. I never heard that before. In the original Satipatthana, it was in the last Satipatthana, the Dhamma section of the Satipatthana, that everything other than five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors, they weren't in the original. I've never heard that before. I don't think you've got it right there. I think it's just misreading it. They both were saying in just the last of the Satipatthanas, the fourth Satipatthana, everything except the first two, the Satipatthana, of the Dhamma, the mind objects of hindrances and seven enlightenment factors, that was all there was. Other things weren't there. So, please prove me wrong, but I haven't heard of them before. Thursday, most venerable Ajahn Brahm. Most venerable? You mean I can't get more venerable? I go to these conferences, and actually most venerable, they say, it's actually the Vietnamese Buddhist community arranges this. If you have been a monk for more than 40 years, then you can be called most venerable. But what about 50 years? And they say that's extreme venerable. And what about 60 years? Ultimately extreme venerable. And titles. So my real title is H.R. Ajahn Brahm. You know what that means? His roundness, yes. His roundness, Ajahn Brahm. And my nickname, which somebody on a retreat in question time, they told me this, and I thought it was a wonderful nickname, and the nickname was Ajahn Donut. So why donut? Well, it's round, it's sweet, and it's holy in the middle. So that's my Ajahn Donut. I quite like that. Most venerable Ajahn, his roundness Ajahn Donut. Deep gratitude for another insightful and inspiring retreat. I have to leave tomorrow. Don't worry. Try Ananda method. If you're my age, get up in the middle of the night, go to the toilet, and then you have another chance, two chances every night, to get Ananda enlightenment. Would like to contribute to your collection of jokes. Hopefully they will improve. No way. What did the horse say to the one-legged jonkey? What did the horse say to the one-legged jonkey? How are you getting on? How are you getting on? What did the jockey say to the horse? Why the long face? Very good. Okay, when anyone tells a joke like that, I have this. Your karma, you're going to get one back. Up in Australia, in the bush, one of my friends, he was travelling with one of these indigenous elders. You've got so much understanding about just, herbs and medicines and stuff. And so as we were driving along, they sort of hit a rabbit on the road. And immediately stopped. And this poor little bunny was, lying there dead, been hit by the car. And the indigenous elder just said, wait a moment. He went into the car, and out of his bag he got some sort of ointment. And he started rubbing this ointment on the belly of the bunny. And he started to twitch. Signs of life appeared. So he rubbed some more on, and it twitched some more. He rubbed some more on. It opened his eyes and it moved its paw. And he kept on rubbing it on and it started to stand up, first of all a bit shaky, and then it started walking away. And every few steps it would turn around and it would wave at its saviors. And it walked a bit further, turned around, walked a bit further, getting stronger every time. And then it started, you know, just walking really fast. You couldn't call it really running, but every few steps it turned around. And then it started running, and by the time it just, you know, grew over the hill, out of the distance, it was running as good as ever, every now and again, sort of waving at its saviors, at its people who helped him. And my friend just turned around to the indigenous elders. What the heck was that? That was a miracle. That was amazing. You know, your knowledge of herbs and medicines was out of this world. He said, oh no, that wasn't indigenous stuff. That was the stuff I got from the supermarket. What was it? Oh, it was hair restorer with a permanent wave. My hair is gone with a permanent wave. Okay. You asked for it. Does the Buddha believe in God or a supreme being and that our lives are predetermined by a supreme being? Please clarify. No. There is higher beings, devas, very high beings, but they're not supreme. The Dhamma is more supreme than anything else. So, my little argument there, which, if you just say, if you're in a conference and meeting people from different faiths and cultures, if you go around saying, oh, Buddhists don't believe in God, you know, it doesn't actually get anywhere. And then sometimes people feel that, you know, that you're not really respecting their beliefs, and it gets very controversial. So, well, that happened to me once. I was in a chaplaincy conference, over in University of Western Australia, and my co-presenter was Abbot Placid from the Benedictine Monastery, his good friend. Now, two abbots. There's only two abbots in the whole of Western Australia at the time, so, you know, we'd actually just have little meetings together, abbot business. And, you know, it doesn't really matter if it was a Catholic monastery or a Buddhist monastery, the same sort of problems. You know, some of these people just, you know, were a little bit mentally disturbed. And, you know, they would actually go to his monastery and cause problems. And then they'd come to Bodhinyana Monastery and cause problems. So, you know, we had like a common like blacklist, warning list. So when somebody came, I'd ring them up and say, this guy, oh yeah, him. We know all about him. So it was really nice, you know, because having just another person to talk with. You know, because we could share a lot of information. Just like, you know, the CIA and MI5 or MI6, you know, they share information. So that was like, yep. So anyway, at this conference, this fellow put his hand up and he announced he was Father Frank Brennan. And I thought, oh my goodness, I've heard of him before. He's one of the high intellectuals in Australia. He was the person that, I forget which Prime Minister, asked to lead a committee to draft a human rights addition to the Australian Constitution. This is no lightweight. It's not the sort of person you can tell jokes to. They're too serious. A Jesuit. Really intellectual. Very well regarded. So when he put his hand up and asked me, what's the Buddhist idea of God? I knew you couldn't say, oh, we don't believe in God or whatever. That doesn't make any sense to him. So I said, well, look, my friend over here, Abbot Placid, I've known him a long time. I mean, often in our conversations, he's told me that one of his deepest and longest held beliefs, his belief was that everyone is searching for God. Now, first of all, a few years ago, I reject that. That's stupid. You know. But then I said, no, I respect where other people are coming from. I respect that. So he keeps on saying to me, everyone is searching for God. So what do Buddhists search for? What do atheists search for? What are you searching for in the sense of coming here? Peace? Truth? Love? The ability to give love to others and to be loved and to receive love from others. You're looking for meaning? Respect. Because there's many people in our community who just suffer so much because they're not respected. They're different, or there's something odd about them. They're not respected. And all you need to do is to give some little respect, like I deserve. I want respect sometimes. And what people are searching for is respect, peace, truth, sense of freedom, forgiveness, kindness. So those are all the things which, you know, I know my friends, myself, search for. So if everyone's searching for God, and that's what everyone is searching for, that's what God must mean. And straight away, this great intellect said, wow, that's a really good answer. It's the best answer I've heard. Thank you. And it was a good answer because it actually brought people together. It took down walls and barriers instead of making new ones. And it gave something which was helpful and meaningful. So that was what my answer was. So to this day when people ask me that question, does Buddhists believe in God? Well, what do you mean by God? What people are searching for mean truth, peace, freedom, contentment. Just being here, having a happy time. Being successful, which is being happy. So, that's useful. Is working in a company who assemble night vision Google for weapon considered as five traders not right livelihood? It's your intention. Why are you? Because you may be working in a company which makes axes. But that axe may be used actually to, I'm going to say chop down trees, but chop down sustainable plantation trees in order to actually to build a hospital. So it's actually what people use night vision for. It's what you use it for, not actually the making of it. But I remember one of our friends, you know, Dennis Shepherd, he was a president of our Buddhist society for a while, but he volunteered for the Samaritans. People once a month would stay up all night, and people who were suicidal would actually ring just to get some support. You know what he said once? He said one of the most moving calls he ever got was this person who was visiting from UK. And he said that he was the main inventor and developer of the cluster bomb. And, you know, he always thought of it as a deterrent or just like boys' toys, fun, just see what can do. And then I think in the first Iraq war, he actually saw the results of his invention. And he was suicidal, he couldn't stand himself. You know, he said, well, if that falls, and this is his words, which was related to me by Dennis, if that falls in a crowd of people, it's strawberry jam. That's what happens. People just get cut to pieces, cluster bombs. And this was a person who developed it, the main inventor. And you can understand just how difficult that was for Dennis to actually to convince him about forgiveness. He made a mistake, let go. So hard. So be very careful. When you just invent these things, you think, oh, it's not much of a thing. But when you see its results, ooh, that is so difficult. But if it's just night vision, that's not such a... because it can be used for so many different things, not just weapons. In the Dharma class today, you told us about the superpowers that light beings possess. Does this mean that people who are mediums are on a path to enlightenment? And how is it that these mediums talk to people in other realms when all that is left is the stream of consciousness of the deceased? That stream of consciousness usually makes a mind-made body, the ghost, spirits, or just like I said, that Deva, the ex-Thai king. So some mediums can contact people, but some mediums can't. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong. That's the trouble with mediums, you can't trust them. You know, sometimes it's amazing what they predict, and other times it just goes totally wrong, or basically you just misunderstand them. Now, already I think I told you the story of the man who dreamt of the five the five angels. That was a few days ago. There was another man, and he was at home reading the newspaper. A lot of them had an afternoon off. And he heard somebody say, "Go to the casino." And he thought, he's hearing things. So he just carried on reading his newspaper. And he heard it almost like someone speaking to his ear. "Go to the casino." And he was just a bit goosebumped. He heard it clearly. But he knew one of his close relations had just died a short while ago. So when he heard it the third time, "Go to the casino, George." And so he thought, wow, this must be somebody telling me to go there for some good luck. So he went to the casino. And as soon as he went in, he said, "Go to the roulette table. Go to the roulette table." So he went to the roulette table. And listening to this, he's the only one who could hear this. And whoever it was said in his ears, the medium said, "Put $20 on number 17. So he put $20 on number 17, and the croupier threw the ball into the wheel, twirled it, and it went round and round and round, and it fell on number 17. And he could hear in his ear, "Woohoo, yay!" And then he heard whoever it was, the spirit, say, "Put all the winnings on number 3. Put it all on number 3. And so he put everything on number 3. And then the croupier threw the ball, twirled it around, went round and round and round. Number 3! And, you know, he could hear it in his ear. "Yay! Number 3, yes! Put all the winnings on number 27. That's what he heard from the very excited spirit. And so he thought, "No, should I believe this? He already won a lot of money. But if he put it on here, he'd be set for life if he won a third time. So why not?" Because he heard it from the spirit, the medium. And so he put all the winnings on number 27. And now a crowd had gathered up because this was like a really big bet. Twice he'd won. And he was a bit shaking too. And the croupier was a bit concerned because, you know, there was a lot of money at stake. So the croupier threw the ball in and twirled the wheel. Number 27, number 27, number 27. He heard the spirit say in his ear. He was the only one who could hear it. And went round and round and round. And as the wheel came to a stop, it went into number 27. And then it jumped out into the hole next to it. He lost. And he could hear very clearly the spirit say, "Oh, shit." That's how bad we done. Even mediums make it wrong. Even spirits get it upside down. But don't trust the mediums. Fortune tellers, I often say, never trust a poor fortune teller. Okay, proof of powers. Okay, next question. I better hurry up because otherwise we'd be in trouble. There you go. Dear Ajahn, how can we overcome addiction towards social media like Facebook, Instagram? Nowadays, a lot of people have FMO, fear of missing out. If we don't constantly check our social media accounts, very simple. Just go into places which have very, very, very poor reception. That's why we tried that here. Really poor reception. We're in a hollow, and the nearest phone tower, they actually block it because they don't want signals going to the prison up the road. So this is a great place. But still, some of you have found out where you can get some good reception. So somehow or other we've got to sort of block that or something. This, the only way to overcome addiction is to let it go for a while, just cold turkey. And you find actually you're fine. Nothing goes wrong. You find out the great truth that you are not that important. So, that's how to stop it. I don't know, if you really want to try this next time, you know, you do a retreat from Bodhinyana, and you can actually advertise it. All iPhones, tablets have to be handed in at the entrance to the retreat. and you can get them back afterwards. If we had that little ruling, like 8 precepts, it's like 9 precepts. How many of you would like to do that? Let's have a show of hands. No, I think the majority still want that. Because we always think, and you don't need to worry, because you can always say there's a telephone there, or you can get the Jhana Grove website, and if there's any emergencies, they can contact that, or contact, you know, the Eileen on the emergencies, and she will alert you. So you don't need to be worried. You may have like a old mother in the hospital, and you know, you're afraid that, you know, she may be in trouble. So you can actually call the retreat manager, give that number or that email address, and then they can contact you. That means you're safe. So you can actually let go of your mobile phone for a few days. Dear Ajahn, please help. No. Okay. Because it's important to overcome stress that you have to learn how to say no. So that's good to say no. So I tell my, some monks ask me, they say, no, I'm saying no today because I can do so many no's in one day. So they say, Ajahn Brahm, can you please not let us have a cup of tea? No. Can you please, Ajahn Brahm, can you please never go back to Singapore? And I say, no. So that actually helps me feel that, you know, I'm saying no more often. So, okay. Many, many people are still talking. It is not the sound that is the problem. It is their energy. It is still at Singapore levels. Oh, yeah. This impacts everything. Could you please ask for silence? I came for silent retreat, please. There's only a few days and I will make good karma. Okay. Shall we get out the masking tape? Now, honestly, I don't know what it is. One of the first retreats we did with the Singaporeans was at our the North Perth Retreat Centre, and Bianca was the retreat manager. And she came up to me and she said, honestly, she said, please, no more Singaporeans. Can we ban them? They're talking too much. What's wrong with you? Shh. Silence. So, what we can do? Can we have like a noise meter, a sound meter in every room, every cottage? See which is the noisiest ones. Is that a good thing to do? Well, you know, a lot of times, you know, we say, can't people be quiet and quiet and quiet? It's impacted on me. And you're probably the one who's making the most noise. It's really weird that we tend to point out the faults in others, which we're very aware of ourselves. That we're the ones who make the noise. Just like that time, I had just become the abbot of the monastery, so I was really strict when I was young. And so I was walking just actually outside the main hall, and I saw there was a hammer left in the grass. And that hammer was going rusty. It had been out there for quite a few days. And I thought, that is not good enough. That's carelessness. There are people who actually just give $1, $5, small amounts because they want to help, that's all they can do. And just people being just so heedless, not respecting the generosity, the gifts of others. We don't earn it and buy it. It's all the donations which go in the boxes to get little things like hammers. I thought, this is not good enough. It's have to have an object lesson. So I called all the monks. They're just finishing the talk. They had to all go inside. And I really, you know, those days I could be quite fierce. I said, this is not good enough. You should not leave hammers out, you know, into the grass to get wet in the rain and get rusty. That's not respecting the generosity of all the people who look after us. Many were poor. We rely on alms. We don't have our own money. This is gifts from the faithful. You're destroying people's faith. This is not good enough. I don't allow you to do this. And at the very end, I asked people, who did it? Come on. No one put their hand up. And they wouldn't put their hand up. They wouldn't confess. No one confessed. And that disappointed me more than anything else. You know, and I thought maybe I was a bit too fierce. Maybe I should just do it lighter next time. But I still left that hall really disappointed that, you know, whoever did that didn't own up. And as I walked outside the hall, it was then I realized why no one had owned up. I turned around, went back inside and said, "Monks, I now found out who left that hammer in the grass." It was me. I forgot all about it. And I forgot all about it while I was haranguing you. And then only when I left outside, the most embarrassing moment, I thought, "Oh, crikey, that was me." I now remembered. It all became clear. I was really busy and I left it out there. I promised I was going back again. I forgot all about it. And I blamed everybody else. That was a really good lesson. Sometimes you blame other people. You're doing the same yourself. So, if that's the case, if it's really noisy, instead of blaming other people, rather than complain about darkness, light a candle. By which I mean, earplugs. And you said, "But earplugs are really uncomfortable." But that I found out, one of the monks told me that there's this really good type of earplugs which you get from audiologists, not just from a chemist or a shop at the airport. Because you go to the audiologist, they squeeze this silicon in your ear, wait for it to set, pull it out, and that's the mold for which you get these earplugs. And they're absolutely amazing. Take a week or two before they come back from the shop. And, you know, different size for different ears. And you put them in. And the reason I got them, as soon as I got them, they thought it was because I couldn't stand my wife snoring. They didn't realize I was a monk. "I haven't got a wife, doesn't snore." So that's what most people get them for. Save people's marriages. But I wanted them because whenever I went traveling, I could never sleep on the aircraft. Not even meditate, it was just too noisy. So the first time I put them on Singapore Airlines from Perth, I sat down in the seat, started to meditate, put the earplugs in. You know what happened? I fell fast asleep. I was trying to meditate, but it was the first time I had a decent sleep on the aircraft. And when I woke up, I thought, "Wow, wonderful. I need to go to the toilet." And as I was walking to the toilet, I thought, "Wow, this aircraft is really quiet." And I forgot I had the earplugs in. You didn't even feel them. They're brilliant. And so I also use those, you know, when, say you go to the, if you sleep at the BF, because sometimes there's that restaurant just outside. And sometimes they can go on really noisy. Don't mind them. I'll put my earplugs in, I'm fine. So try those earplugs. They're really nice. When, if you want to meditate somewhere where it's just noisy, they really work. So that's one thing you can do for next time. At night while sleeping, we hear, okay, let's see what this is. I'll continue here. It starts here. My goodness. "Thank you for all the inspirational teachings and great sense of humor. Here's one for you." Oh, it's a joke. Excellent. "A 9-year-old boy is learning about history and government in school. He came home and told his father he was confused about the hierarchy of all the government branches. The father explains, it's easy. Let me help you sort it out. You see, since I am the head of the household, I am the government. Your mum would be the people, and the maid would be the worker. Do you understand?" The boy replied, "Yes." The father said, "Why don't you go to bed and I'll explain more tomorrow?" At night, while the boy is sleeping, he hears his little sister crying for a long time without stopping. He walked into his sister's room and found she pooped all over the bed, but he did not see his parents attending to her. He walked to his parents' room and found his mum sleeping. He walked around the house trying to find his father. He found his father, in the maid's room. Should I carry on? It's a bit naughty, but you wrote it. It's not my fault, okay. I've already started. In the morning at breakfast, his father asked if he had any questions in understanding what was explained yesterday regarding hierarchy of government. The boy replied, "I understand, all right. The government is screwing the worker while the people is unaware and the future is full of shit." Ha ha ha. Okay, nice try. Please clarify the will again. How is it that some are weak and others are strong? Sometimes people take weakness as something which is to be corrected. But remember the old story about the tree and the reed in the wind? The tree is strong and big, but it gets blown over by the wind. But the so-called weak can bend this way with the wind. And so in the storms, it survives. While the big, strong ones are the ones who get destroyed. It's not will which makes you survive and strong. It's wisdom. You always call wisdom power, never willpower. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned that if there's no breath, then that is not killing. What about abortion of a 2 to 4 week embryo? Precisely, because this is where even the Buddha defines when life begins. And life begins when consciousness first manifests, first appears in the mother's womb. And consciousness only first appears, I forget what stage now, so 16 weeks or something, I forget now, some gynecologist once told me. But before that time, the fetus in the womb with an ultrasound does not respond to any stimulus, pain or sort of pleasure, because its neural network is yet to form. It cannot experience, according to the... It cannot manifest pain or pleasure. Consciousness is not manifested there. By manifest means appeared, can be seen. And said, before that time, it's not counted as a human being. It's interesting, because what that means is, before that time, when the fetus is developed, it's not regarded as killing a human. So the early abortions in Buddhism, they're not considered to be killing. There was, when I was in Sydney just a few months ago, there was one Sri Lankan woman. She said her daughter was really, really concerned that many people were calling her a murderer, because she did late-term abortions. She was one of two doctors permitted in New South Wales to do late-term abortions. Abortions of 10, 12-year-old girls who've been raped. Extreme cases. She could only do this with the government's permission, going through an ethics panel. But there had to be some very extreme cases where that was permitted, and she'd be the one who did it. When her mother asked me, was that really bad karma? I said, it's karma, but is it bad or is it good? What was your intention? And I told her a little story, which when I was visiting my mother many years ago, she was watching the news on TV, and I was watching it with her, and there was this very interesting ethical dilemma which was real. It was happening in a hospital in Wales. A mother had two fetuses in her womb, and the doctor's second opinion, third opinion, fourth opinion, it was really conclusive that if the doctors didn't do anything, both of those unborn children plus the mother would die. It was a certainty. But if the doctor aborted one of those beings in the mother's womb, the mother and the other one would survive. It was very, very clear. There's no doubt about that. No one questioned that. Only some people said, what should the doctor do? Now, if that was you, you had the duty of care. You were a Buddhist doctor. And one patient was in that situation. You abort one of those fetuses in the mother's womb. The other one would survive, and so would the mother. Do nothing, and all three would die. What would you do? When I asked that question, most people will put their hand up and said, yes, they would abort one child to save the other two. Compassion, kindness. Compassion for one, but it's murdering the other two. Well, compassion for two, or just everyone die. It's a very real ethical dilemma. And what it points out is that it is the measure of the karma, the quality of the karma, is your motivation. Why are you doing that? Where is that coming from? Is it coming from letting go, from kindness and gentleness, from right motivation? Or is it coming from something else? But one of the nice things about Buddhism is in the end, you make your decision yourself. And when it comes to abortions, there's one thing which is very clear to me, and I get actually quite passionate about. Why is it that men tell you whether it's right or wrong? Why is it that mostly men sort of make those rules? Even why do they ask me? I've never been pregnant in this life. How do I know what a female feels when they're pregnant and they, some reason they can't go through with their pregnancy? And of course, that happens as a spiritual leader. They come up to me and decide, I'm pregnant, but there's all sorts of complications, or what should I do? I can never tell a person what to do. All I can give them is some advice. You have to make that decision for yourself. But one thing I'll always say, I will never criticize you beforehand. And whichever way you go, I will just be there for you, kindness supporting you in one of the most difficult decisions in your life. It's like between a rock and a hard place, both ways you lose. And what I have found is many women have been through abortions. And they feel so terrible about it. They need support. They need respect, kindness, forgiveness. The last thing they need is to be vilified. It's hard enough as it is. But to be told that you're a bad Buddhist, you made a sin, you're going to suffer for that, that is unacceptable to me. That's even worse than the abortion. So anyway, it's a tough question. No woman ever does that lightly. No woman I've ever talked to. It's the most difficult decision in your life. And you do it with as much kindness. What you think is the best for everybody. No one aborts sort of easily. So, that's what I can say as a male. And sometimes I think it's really not fair that men make those decisions and tell you what's right and what's wrong. Sorry, but that's how I feel. Anyway, the last question here. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you said if a relationship is a crack, we should care for it. If my spouse says the crack is too deep, with no possibility of reconciliation, divorce is the only option, should I use superglue? Superglue can mend so many cracks. Now that sometimes, you know, that all things have a use-by date, and sometimes relationships are lasted for such a long, long time, and sometimes that even both parties feel that it's time to move on. But when one party does, the other party doesn't. Again, so often, what causes a major problem is the guilt. And I think, oh, why did I do that? You know, I'm at fault. And please, again, it's not sort of gender stereotyping. And all the people I've met, it is the women who blame themselves the most. And that's not fair. And it's not right. It's not healthy. You know, it's not your fault. Don't blame yourselves. It just, sometimes relationships end. Use by date. It's anicca, impermanent. So the wonderful thing, if a relationship does end and you realize it's gone, it's finished, then don't blame anybody. Take away the guilt and the feeling of, just I'm wrong, or just it's his fault, or it's my fault. Those are the things which cause most of the pain. If you can keep it going, it's wonderful, because it's a lot of letting go. So, if you think it's gone too far, then no possibility of reconciliation. Divorce is the only option. Should I show more care and kindness, happy to save this, hoping to save this marriage? You have to be realistic. You know, and just, you know, is it savable? Is it worthwhile keeping going? Is it on life support? Is it time to pull the plug? Or let go? That's where no one can actually tell you. So how do you make that decision? I always say, just don't think about it, feel it in your heart. Feel, is it the right time to go? Is it, you know, is it the time to try another time? And that's from a very wise monk who's never been married. So why are you asking me that question for? You know, one of the most frightening times of my life. It was at the old college I was at. One of my friends got married, and so, you know, all his mates were there, and I was there. And after the marriage, when we're having the reception, and all my friends, you know, you met that Jeff and Bernard, all talking to one another, and a stupid male conversation came up. Who's going to be next? And somebody pointed to one of my friends, oh, he'll be next. Nah, no one would marry him. And then they pointed to me. You know, my lay name was Peter. Oh, Peter will be next. And they said, ah, no one will marry him. And there's this little girl standing next to me. And she whispered into my ear, I would. Ah! I've never been so frightened in my whole life. I just moved away and I made sure I would never get close to that girl for weeks and months. I was so terrified. You think, oh, poor girl. But I was terrified of that. So anyway, you know, that's what happens with relationships. You go in to a relationship, not with starry eyes, knowing that, you know, it might work, it might not work. So you give it everything you've got, and if it doesn't work out, well, you tried your best. So go out with peace and happiness and joy. Just like even this talk has its use-by date. And I've already gone past it, so now's the time for sadhus. Sadhu! 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 Very good. Okay, and Venerable Chan is going to the airport now. Don't worry, you'll be plenty of time. Very good. Who's taking you?